You are listening to the Brighton Book Club on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, a monthly show about books and writing in Brighton and beyond. This month we speak to Elizabeth Dilo, author of Becoming Liz Taylor, about why she decided to set part of her debut novel in Brighton and how overhearing a conversation in a queue sparked the whole idea for the book. We also talked to Brighton-based Deborah Price about her memoir, The Peanut Factory, about living in London squats in the 1980s. We talked to Brighton-based Joseph Zygmunt about his debut novel, Constance, a book that came from two very different ideas, one about teenage relationships and the mistakes we make, and another about what happens when climate breakdown starts coming home. We take a deep dive into this month's book club book, Eliza Clark's wonderful Penance. We discuss all things from falling asleep to true crime podcasts, to seeing your work adapted to the stage and to the horrors of teenage female relationships. The Brighton Book Club is also available as a podcast where you can download from wherever you get yours. I also have a small ask for you. It's Radio Reverb's Reverbathon, our yearly fundraiser in September. And if you enjoy the Brighton Book Club and want to help keep us on air and talking to wonderful authors and recommending great books, please do make a donation at www.radioreverb.com/donate. Just one click and a couple of quid makes all the difference. And make sure you pop Brighton Book Club in the reference, because I'm an overachiever and I want them to know how many fans the show has. So without waffling on more, here is the show. Elizabeth Dilo, welcome to the Brighton Book Club and congratulations on the publication of your debut novel, Becoming Liz Taylor, which is out now with Atlantic. Can you tell us about this book and what inspired it?
Of course, yes. So thank you for having me on. Thank you so much. It's really exciting to be here. So Becoming Liz Taylor is the story of Val. She's a 72-year-old widow who lives in Weston-super-Mare on the coast of Somerset. She lost her baby son and then her husband Len in back-to-back tragic events back in the 1970s. And she's never got over her grief. But she gets some quiet pleasure, some solace during her lonely evenings in her terraced house in Weston, dressing up as the film star Elizabeth Taylor. And she does it, I think, because it makes her feel close to Len, her husband, who died all those years back, all those decades back. But he used to tell her that she looked like her. One day when Val is walking home from the hairdresser, she's walking along the seafront and she notices a baby in a pram that's been left momentarily unattended. And a little detail on the baby's blanket reminds Val of the child she lost. And on a whim, she kicks off the brake and walks away with the baby. Meanwhile, in a parallel storyline, and this is alternating chapters, we have her existing son, Rafe. He is in his 50s. He lives in Brighton, and he's been estranged from Val for many years. He was once a very successful businessman. He ran an art gallery. He was in a relationship. But his life has kind of gone badly wrong since his relationship broke up due to his own sort of possessive jealousy. He is a bit of a broken man, volunteering in a charity shop. He's skint. He's living in a council flat, and his sort of life has kind of fallen out. He fled from Weston-super-Mare when he was 18, as soon as he possibly could, mainly because Val freaked him out, really. You know, the sight of her cooking his tea dressed up in a ball gown and tiara used to unsettle him. He just wanted to leave her. He's also angry at her because she never explained about the death of his father that he witnessed as well as her. And also he's gay, and Weston-super-Mare was a very stifling place to grow up in the 1980s. So as soon as he possibly could, he got out of there. So we've got these two sort of broken people living in two very contrasting seaside towns who are estranged and who at the end of the story come together.
So this book, as you said, Liz, is partly set in Brighton. Why did you decide to set it there?
I think the location of Weston came first. I actually came up, I came across the idea of the novel. I was in a queue actually, and I had two women. I was going to see an art gallery, an art exhibition, and there were two women behind me, and they said, "Oh, have you heard about this woman who lives around who walks around this seaside town dressed as Elizabeth Taylor?" So you know, as a writer, I'm supposed to go home and write up those sorts of things in a notebook, which I instantly did. And I thought, my goodness, that's so interesting. Why would a person dress as Elizabeth Taylor, walk around a seaside place? To what degree was she dressing as Liz Taylor? Was she, you know, was it just a nod to her? Was it just the turban and maybe, you know, a bit of jewellery? Or did she go full on, you know, the beauty spot and the fur coat and all of that? So this character, and I just wanted to set that in Weston-super-Mare. I wanted it to be an old-fashioned place, you know, an old-fashioned seaside town, which had its heyday back in the 50s and 60s, probably when, you know, Val herself was having her heyday. I'm from the West Country originally, and I used to go to Weston all the time as a kid, so I know that location really well. And then I wanted Rafe to live in a completely contrasting place, but I thought it would be interesting to have two contrasting seaside towns. So Brighton was the obvious one. It's, you know, in a way, it's the antithesis to Weston, in that it's cool, it's vibrant, it's very now, it's always having its heyday, isn't it? It'll be having its heyday forever. And also, I lived in Brighton. I used to live in Brighton. I lived in Kemp Town for a short time, actually, in the 1990s. I've got friends in Brighton. I'm there a lot. So I feel like I know both locations well.
And did you find out anything really interesting about Brighton when you were kind of writing the book or researching it?
I just loved recreating all the places that I know and love, you know, just all the stuff about the pier, which I'm going to read to you a little bit at the moment. I was curious in just to sort of just, I think I lived in Kemp Town, so I just wanted to for Rafe's life to be in Kemp Town, for all its sort of, you know, the underbelly of Kemp Town, the kind of, you know, Brighton is this sort of shouty, fantastic, wonderful holiday makers, you know, place. But there's also a little bit of sadness in corners of Brighton as well, which, you know, possibly I touched on when I was living there a little bit. So, yeah, I wanted to show Brighton in all its sort of forms.
Lovely. Can we hear some, please?
Of course, yeah. So I was going to read a bit at the start where Val takes the baby, but as this is Brighton Book Club, I'm going to read an extract from one of the Brighton chapters. So this is Rafe. He has just been into a cafe and bumped into his former partner and lover, Jim, along with Jim's new partner, Clem. Rafe broke up with Jim 5 years ago, but he's still brokenhearted. He's a broken man because of it. And he is horrified and devastated to find out that Jim and this Clem are not only together, but they're married. So in this scene that I'm about to read, Rafe has just fled the cafe and is heading down to Brighton seafront. Rafe crossed the main road and went down the steps onto the walkway above the beach. The sky was the colour of steel. Beyond the rusting turquoise railings, beyond the banks of pebbles, the grey waves tumbled and heaved. Seagulls screeched mournfully, their bodies buffeted on the thermals this way and that. A dirty bassline thudded from a bar under the arches. The breeze was jerked chicken and sticky rice, battered fish, seaweed, and brine. Rafe scrambled across the pebbles and down the shingle banks. They gave way under his weight so that he sank with each footstep, making the going hard, escalating his frustration. He skidded down the last of the banks, stood on the shore, and shouted into the roar of the waves. He stayed there for a long time, hollering his despair at the sea. He moved back from the shore and sat down on the beach. He cupped his face in his hands and watched the grey swell of the sea, sensing the energy of the waves. Clem. He supposed he'd always known that Jim would end up with someone like Clem, some younger media type. As he thought about the scene in the cafe, though, he began to feel a little ashamed that he hadn't asked Clem more about himself. He could have been friendlier, should have been. He worried now that he'd come across like some pathetic, angry cuckold. It was just such a shock seeing them in there together, seeing Jim, the unbearableness of loving someone. Over by the pier, the lights reflected in the water, rides illuminated against the navy blue sky. The long arm of the booster ride held its terrified thrill seekers upside down over the water, and Rafe could hear their muffled screams. Jim often used to drag him onto the pier. Rafe would indulge him by agreeing to go on the ghost train. Jim could never get enough of it. They had to do it every time. They both loved the Dolphin Derby and were fiercely competitive. Two pairs of quick-fire hands pushed balls into holes, making the Dolphins buck across the course. Afterwards, they would stop at the seafood kiosk and sit on the beach, eating vinegary cockles with wooden forks out of polystyrene pots, then position the empty pots on the shingle and aim pebbles into them. The wind was colder now, and the last light had drained from the sky. Rafe was glad of his jumper and pulled the polar neck up to his chin. Shaking himself out of his daydream, he made himself get up and start back up the beach. What's done was done. It wouldn't do to get maudlin. There'd been enough of that.
Oh, thank you so much, Liz. It's such moving, beautiful writing. So vivid of Brighton.
Thanks.
So I'd love to know, so I've read that you were basically writing in your spare time between kind of juggling family commitments and work for years. And now, as of very recently, you are a published author. What is it like?
What is it like? It's surreal. It's strange. It's exciting. It's thrilling. Terrifying, actually. Because you're exposing yourself in a way that you wanted to do, but you know, well, actually, you're typing away. When I was doing my master's degree in creative writing at Bath Spa University, and you're sort of, you know, typing away, you're writing this manuscript and you're thinking, oh, no one's going to read this, you know, only my manuscript tutor. And then suddenly the book's picked up and it's bought by a publisher and you're, oh my goodness, what have I exposed, what have I revealed about myself? You know, because even though it's fiction, you realize how much you've put in of yourself, you know. And it's only when you read through, when I actually you edit it, that you think, oh my goodness, that's subconsciously, I wasn't planning to write that, but it's in there, you know. There's this person and there's this hurt from that, you know, from that time, and you know, it's all in there, really. But but I won't pretend that it's not marvellous. It is absolutely brilliant. The going into a bookshop and seeing my book on the shelf is just something that I've worked for so many years. You know, I've been writing since, about 2008 was when I bought my first notebook and started writing. I wrote a whole novel, which I wrote and rewrote about two or three times, which got me my agent. But didn't sell, actually. And then I got the opportunity to do the master's at Bath Spa. And by then I had the idea for Becoming Liz Taylor and I was away. You know, that gave me time and license to write and write and write. And actually, it was even better than I thought, because it was 2020 when I'd arranged to go on the course. And as much as I was hoping for a new, you know, university experience, you know, 30 years since the last one, it didn't kind of, you know, it didn't happen like that. And I was actually typing away in my bedroom. But what it did do is it gave me endless time to write the book, which, so I probably did it slightly, you know, quicker than I would have done in the end.
And the reader responses have been gorgeous so far. Just a cursory Google search shows some really heartfelt reviews. What's it like kind of reading what people think of your book?
It's absolutely brilliant. I'm delighted with the reviews that are coming in. I mean, I said it was exciting to see the book on the shelves, but actually what is better, what is so satisfying is getting readers' responses and getting people, you know, messaging me and saying that they loved it, that Val is chiming with them, you know. It was really hard writing Val because she does something terrible. You know, she does a really terrible crime. She steals somebody's baby, essentially. And even though she goes on these flights of fancy, she's delusional, she's deluded. But in the back of her mind, I think she knows that what she's done is wrong. I think she just wants to have that baby. She has done something, you know, almost one of the worst things you can do is steal somebody's child. Mm-hmm. So what I wanted to do was make her sympathetic. And it was a hard balance, you know, given that she'd done this awful thing, was to give her all this backstory and all this sadness so that readers would understand her motivations, would understand why she did it, and also kind of get it with her grief, you know, her historical grief that's gone on for so long. And they understood that this is not some callous crime, but Val's hurting, you know, that's why she's done it. And I'm so pleased that readers are getting that, and that's coming through, and that they all love Val and they're rooting for her. And that has been absolutely brilliant.
Amazing. Thank you so much for joining us, Elizabeth. How can we find and follow you?
Okay, I've got a website, which is elizabethdelo.com. I'm on Twitter as Elizabeth_Delo, and I'm on Instagram, Elizabeth Delo Writer.
Brighton-based Deborah Price is the author of The Peanut Factory, a 70s squatter memoir set in South London. Deborah joins us to talk more about her vibrant memoir. Deborah, welcome to the Brighton Book Club, and tell us about The Peanut Factory.
Thank you. Well, The Peanut Factory is it's a memoir, and it's about 8 years that I spent in South London living in squats. And it was during the late 70s, early 1980s. So during a time of civil unrest, punk music, a lot of young people living together, places that were very run down, but it meant that we could live rent free.
Can you read an extract for us?
Yes, I can. So this extract is about hair, because I was looking through thinking, what shall I read? And I thought, what am I going to do with my hair is quite a universal topic. So I thought I'd read you this bit. So another regular outing was to a home hairdresser in a squat in Relton Road, the front line. I'd never bothered with hairdressers. I associated them with my mum and the times I had to sit for hours with curlers under a hot dryer with nothing but old copies of Reader's Digest to thumb through. I always emerged with big bouncy curls that I hated. Since then, I cut my own hair or got Joe to do it. He pierced my ear as well with an ice cube and a cork and a needle. It worked quite well. Tessa had a perm. She was going for a coupe sauvage, very in vogue, but they set her hair on big rollers and she got the inevitable big bouncy curls. She came round crying with a hat on. I pulled it off and stuck her head under the tap in the little sink in our room. She emerged with the small corkscrew curls that I was aiming for. I was inspired and tried a home perm. It went quite well. When my mum saw me, she said, "You look just like Barbara Streisand." High praise indeed. The Relton Road squat was occupied by a crowd of gay men who coexisted happily with the local community, and during the riots were at the barricades on the front line, chucking bricks with the best of them. Getting my hair cut was exciting and as far removed from a normal hairdresser as it could be. For a start, the house was always full of people. "It's a knocking shop," explained Connor, the hairdresser. "If boys don't have a room, they come here. We feel it's a public service." There did seem to be trails of slightly sheepish men coming up and down the stairs at all times of the day and night. Secondly, there was no mirror in the room, so I was never quite sure what was being done until it was finished. "Ta-da," Connor would say, and show me his handiwork in a small hand mirror. The first time I went, I was feeling adventurous and fed up with the traditional long hair with fringe that I've had since my teens. With my foray into new music and abandonment of the hippie look, I'd inched the length up, but it still wasn't anything very interesting. Connor raised an eyebrow as I settled into the chair and put a grubby towel round me and sprayed my crop with water. "Oh, just do whatever," I said. Shall I dye it as well? I paused to think. It'll take a while, he said. I had the whole day and Connor had a minion who was making tea, so I threw caution to the winds. Oh, go on then, I said. I'll have to go quite short to get rid of this perm. Is that okay? I nodded, speechless. It felt like the end of an era. When he was finished, all that I knew was that everything felt light and I smelt of bleach. There seemed to be a lot of hair on the floor and I felt like Jo March in Little Women. I paid and squinted in the hand mirror and spent the whole journey home trying to see my reflection in the bus and shop windows. I couldn't see very clearly. I thought one or two people gave me a bit of a look, but I wasn't sure. I got home and clattered down the stairs to see if Tessa was in. Oh, my good God, she said. Come into the light in the kitchen. I stood by the back door as she held a mirror up for me. My hair was in a pixie crop with the fringe and back bits coloured a bright blue. Tessa grinned. Do you like it? I said nervously. I love it, she said, her curls bobbing about as she nodded. Wow, Johnny said as he came in to see what all the noise was about. I was pleased. He was the type of man who never noticed what people were wearing or how they looked. I got good reactions from everyone in the house. Pam grunted and raised her eyebrows. She'd never really recovered from the Mel incident or the haircut she let the Traveller boys do to her. I hope she never asked them to dye her hair. The damage they could do with a packet of bleach would be incredible. I was desperate to show my mum my hair. She was normally up for anything new or in fashion. I was hoping for the same sort of comment I got with the perm. I wasn't sure that Streisand ever had blue hair, though. I bumped into her in Westo Street. She was up from Brighton visiting my Auntie Jean and on her way to the Queen's Arms. I called out and she clearly saw me then cross the street. I was mortified and crossed over and ran after her to demand an explanation. What do you think you're doing ignoring me? You look like a budgie, she spat out. I don't want people to see us together. I was hurt, although I could see the truth in what she said, and it did turn me against the blue a little.
Thank you so much. So I'm really fascinated by the kind of concept of writing memoir and the limitations you can come up against, you know, the unreliability of memory and how people, you know, real people might feel that they are portrayed in your work. Can you speak a bit to this?
Sure. I was worried as well, actually. So what I did is one of the people, unfortunately, I'm no longer in contact with, so I couldn't do anything about her, but I changed the names of everyone in the book, except, surprisingly, my Auntie Jean. I kind of forgot, because in my head she was always my Auntie Jean, so she remains Auntie Jean and she doesn't actually mind. But I changed the names of everyone else in the book. And then the main character, Joe, my boyfriend, I'm actually still in touch with him and I sent him a draft. And I was a bit worried because, you know, it isn't his finest hour in a lot of the book. But he was fine with it. He said, no, that's what happened. And I did a little bit of research and all the incidents in the book, everything that happens in the book happened. Obviously, some of the conversations and the chat I've made up or I've based it on what might have been said, but everything that happened happened. And my feeling was that anyone who was upset about it, A, their name was changed and B, it was the truth. It was my truth anyway. It is what happened.
And what is it like to be a writer in Brighton? We've got such a vibrant community here.
It's fantastic. I mean, I'm a member of a writing group that I've been a member of for ages and we meet regularly and look at each other's work. I'm also a member of a smaller group where we just sit and write together. NaNoWriMo, which I must do a plug for, National Novel Writing Month. It's the whole of November and it's free to register. And you write, I think, something like 1,600 words a day. You don't edit, you just write every day. And at the end of November, you've got a 50,000 word draft. And the Peanut Factory started as a NaNoWriMo draft. And in Brighton, there's a big NaNoWriMo community. Mm-hmm. So there's people that you can write all sorts of things with every day of the week, I would think. And there's obviously the Coast is Queer, the wonderful LGBT+ festival that's going to be coming at the end of October.
Absolutely. So how can we find and follow you, Deborah, and catch up with your latest projects?
Well, on Instagram, I'm Deborah Price. And I am on Twitter, but I've kind of gone off Twitter a little bit. So Instagram is probably the best thing for me. Or Guts Publishing is who the Peanut Factory is published with. So yeah, that would be great if people followed me. I have got a novel that's already edited and ready to go. So I'm looking for an agent or a publisher for that. Unfortunately, Guts Publishing, who published The Peanuts Factory, they only do memoirs and collections, so they can't pick up my novel.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Deborah, and we look forward to seeing that novel whenever it appears in the world.
My pleasure. It's going to be called Dirty Sweet. Well, that's what it's called at the moment anyway.
In the summer of 2006, a chance encounter on the London Underground finds 18-year-old Ali tagging along with a school friend and a mysterious girl to a club. The girl is Cece, and she seems to be everything Ali is not. For one night, he is transfixed and transformed into someone who might belong. All he knows is he will remember it forever. In 2064, Ali takes his final flight out of the UK to Morocco, in a world upturned by climate collapse. He has a wife and a daughter, reasons to return. Yet Ali is willing to abandon everything to find Cece again, finally to recapture that long summer night when he was young and to understand how the actions taken and not taken have changed all their lives. Luminous and full of longing, Constance is a novel of teenage fragility, male blindness and everyday complicity. Joseph Sigmund, welcome to the Brighton Book Club and congratulations on publication of your debut novel.
Thank you very much. You read that copy beautifully. You should do the audiobook.
I'd love to. Where did the inspiration come from, Joseph? Because this is a really fascinating concept.
It's actually embarrassingly, basically, I was trying to write two different projects at the same time. And I just got to a point where I realized that I was too time poor to try and actually execute both of them. And so I kind of ended up being lazy and I thought, well, I don't want to throw either of them away. I'm fond of both of them. What would happen if I smushed them both into the same book? And so the two different projects was like, one was about teenage relationships and, you know, how we make mistakes as when we're kids and how those mistakes go on to make us when we become adults. And you know, the invisible damage that teenagers in particular inflict on each other when they're in that very kind of insular, selfish phase of their lives. And then the other one, completely different, was what happens to us as a society when climate breakdown starts coming home. And when I say home, I mean, you know, like to the very affluent developed world. And not in terms of fire and famine, but you know, what are the little changes going to be that start cropping up in our lifetimes? And one of those was when aviation travel starts getting capped, as inevitably it will, you know, the dramatic potential of situations where people can't fly as much as they want to. So what relationships, for example, romantic relationships, will that kind of thing cut through? Who will it separate? And what does the future look like? So I had those two kind of very disparate worlds, and I just kind of chucked them into the same Word document and saw how they fell together. And as you kind of read the copy so beautifully, you can kind of tell that, you know, one is at the beginning of that timeline and the other one ends up at the end of it. And the book is about the life that connects those two worlds.
Wonderful. Can you read us some, please?
Oh, yeah. This is from the very beginning of the book. It's from that 2064 timeline, and it's the main character, no longer a teenager, now an old man, finally reuniting with that mysterious girl that he met on the tube. In time, he will remember the foyer as sandstone, but in fact it is pale green plaster, lime washed and cool to the touch. He will forget how he rests his weight against it in full sight of the staff and waits for his inhales to supply the demand of his exhales. There is a lag in his vision too, and a tremble in his knees, and somehow the certain knowledge that he is going to fall. I am gone, he thinks. I have lost myself. I am not myself. I am not. and the humiliating prospect of being helped to his feet is matched only by the fear of not being helped at all. How low he has come. But his breathing begins to rebalance. The air, mixed clove and vanilla, returns, and he knows he won't collapse. He will see it through. I am vertical, he thinks. I am still here. I was always going to be fine. His recovery is quick, accelerated by pride. He walks to the atrium with only a slight hesitation, taking his reader from his bag. He tests his heart rate, breathing, blood sugar. He is an old man, they say. Part of him regards this, even now, as an outright error. As he turns into the corridor, he leans once more against the wall to fish out a tablet or two. It's as much an excuse to rest again as anything else. The only sight he will later recall as he reaches the atrium will be of her. But at the time, he is struck by the desolation of the place, the mosaic of broken glass lining the ground, shredded wires like spiders' webs across the corners, a perfect shell hole in the roof where pigeons now roost. A set of reveling tramp Westerners is packing up, either drunk or high on kiff or intoxicated by their power to break the silence of the courtyard. The smell of their food, half eaten, half destroyed, honeyed fazuelos ripped to ribbons, which the waiter gathers carefully, licking his fingers between sweeps. Between their table and hers, he manages to subdue rapid breaths, and then there she is, simply there, an old woman now, her long hands clasped, the line of her grey fringe fraying slowly in the breeze, the tall glass of water before her seeming to hold all that she is in the heat of those ceasefire days.
Oh, it's such beautiful writing, Joseph, and it is a particularly stunningly written book. You work in nonfiction publishing for a large publisher, and you are now an author with a small independent publisher. What's your experience been like kind of coming in from the other side?
Pretty weird. So my job, yeah, is nonfiction. It's what we call serious nonfiction in kind of industry lingo, which all that means is I kind of work with experts, historians and journalists, and people who know what they're talking about in their field, very much unlike me. And they the books I edit are about things that have happened, and the guardrails are reality. So there's really no scope to kind of mess with that. So it's a really, really different experience kind of stepping out of obviously reality and into fiction and having no guardrails whatsoever. Just constantly knowing that any point, I could add unicorns into this book or any, it probably wouldn't work. I didn't try it, but it's very strange. A really nice kind of release valve from that kind of work that I do. As for working, with an indie, it's been just so inspiring, and Indigo, my publisher, they kind of did it with such focus and dedication, and what I love about sort of the way they do things is they publish a very small number of books with enormous amounts of attention. And, you feel like the commercial, the commercial bottom line of this project is really not the be all and end all. It's kind of about how it goes out into the world and whether or not it kind of feels right and meets the right readership and things like that. Not to say that I haven't sold millions of copies, obviously have, but it's about doing justice to it as a piece of writing, and as you can tell from the writing and the way I read it, like, I think that's the thing that always mattered to me the most. So yeah, it's been a very kind of different experience from my day job, and I'm really grateful for that.
So, Joseph, you are Brighton based, and one question I really like to ask our guests is, what is your experience of being a writer in Brighton?
It's just like the most useful place to be creative. I'm a Londoner, so I feel like I can say this. I don't find like it's a hothouse in the way that London is. It doesn't feel like it's you know, the creative people you're talking to are kind of engaged in a keeping up with the Joneses kind of competitive kind of industry of you know, constantly producing work, you know, with the intention of getting ahead. It feels much more like a place where people have gone to in order to express the things that they need and they need to develop in themselves. And I find that when I talk to people who are just readers, when I talk to people who are writers, people who you know, do other kinds of art, musicians, and I don't know why that is. You know, obviously it's got an amazing kind of backstory as a city, but I also think that we're kind of surrounded by access to things that are bigger than ourselves. And you know, it's easy to get complacent about that, but when you've got the downs behind you and you've got the sea in front of you, I think it can't help, even with cynical people like me, to make you a little bit more spiritual and in touch with, you know, the slower rhythms of things. So I don't know, it's definitely made me a better person. I don't know if it's made me a better writer, but I think it's the best place.
I'd argue that it has. So thank you so much for joining us, Joseph. Constance is out now and available from all good bookshops, but I encourage you to have a look up Indigo Press and buy directly from them. Anyone who listens to the Brighton Book Club will know how much I loved Eliza Clark's Boy Parts. It was one of my top reads of 2020. So it was the natural progression that I bring her on to talk about her next book, Penance, which we have chosen as our book club book this month. And it did not disappoint. So I'm really excited to be joined by Eliza to talk more about it. Eliza, welcome back to the Brighton Book Club.
Hello.
So since we last spoke in around 2020, how much has your life as a writer changed?
Gosh, it's changed completely. I think when we spoke in 2020, I mean, obviously it was book launch during the pandemic. That was actually the first in-person event that I did for Boy Parts. And it ended up, I think, aside from, I did like one book festival that year as well. I think aside from that, it ended up being like the only in-person event I did for Boy Parts.
I feel very honoured.
Yeah. I suppose it was kind of during that like sweet spot of between the where we could do things for like about a month in 2020. And yeah, since then, obviously, it's been very different. I mean, there was like, I think in 2021, Boy Parts went kind of viral on TikTok, which was very different. I've also started doing a lot more film and television work. So I don't have a regular day job anymore. I'm just a freelance writer now. And that's obviously made like a huge change to my life generally, and my writing life, being completely self-employed. It's just things are very different. And I do events now. I go outside and travel to places.
So you had the honor of being chosen as one of Granta's best young British novelists, which they only release every 10 years. What did that feel like?
Kind of a mixed bag. I think it's sort of whenever there's kind of like a list or something like that, there's always immediately this conversation about the kind of arbitrary nature of lists, which when you are on the arbitrary list, it does make it a little bit difficult to enjoy being on the list. I think, yeah, it's just also, I guess, the sort of standard, like, slightly prickly British press reaction to that kind of thing as well. So, I mean, it was anxiety-inducing, and I was correct for it to be anxiety-inducing. But I get to have my name on the cool list. So in 10 years' time, people can say, who is that? I've never heard of her.
So there's also a play of Boy Parts coming out at the Soho Theatre. I've got my tickets. I cannot wait. So were you involved in the writing of that script?
Sort of. Basically, I'm not writing it. It's Jill Greer, who works at Soho Theatre, is writing the play script for Boy Parts. But I'm reading it and giving feedback, and I'm going to be kicking about during rehearsals to sort of advise. So I'm present and I'm hovering, but I haven't done any of the hard work.
Excellent. You can just take the credit.
Yeah.
So let's move on to Penance. Can you tell us about this book? Give us your spiel.
So Penance is a fake true crime novel, an untrue crime book, if you like, about one teenage girl who is set on fire by three girls she goes to school with, and that's sort of what the book opens with. So it's a why done it. It is a examination of the crime done by an unscrupulous tabloid journalist who you are warned at the front of the book may or may not have like fabricated a lot of the material in the book.
So this unreliable narrator, Alex Z. Corelli, how did he develop as a character for you? What was your inspiration behind him?
It actually took a long time to get the narrator's voice kind of, or to decide exactly what I was doing with the narrator there. I was trying to keep the voice quite neutral, and I wasn't sure if I wanted to have like an additional layer, and I hadn't really decided who that character was or what exactly he did or what his kind of like backstory was yet. So I was trying to keep it quite neutral. But when I was trying to write in that neutral voice, I just felt like, I don't know, it just ended up feeling a bit like I was, it just sounded really pompous and really like, it sounded really like pompous and annoying. And I couldn't quite get it right. And then I read In Cold Blood by Truman Capote, and I was really, really taken with the writing in that because it's so excellent. And then I was sort of even more taken, I suppose, by when I read about Capote afterwards and the fact that In Cold Blood had been, well, it had been fabricated in a lot of places. Like, he just kind of made stuff up and exaggerated stuff, and it wasn't like it was not a work of fiction, but there was a lot of like fictionalized elements in it that certainly weren't like made clear. And I was just really interested in that, and kind of reading about how sort of later in like Capote alienated a lot of people he knew by like printing things about them in the press, that I was really, really interested in that idea of like the writer who lies, I think, and somebody who's got like kind of control over the narrative and chooses to present like a false or improved version of it, I think is really interesting. And I don't know, I'm kind of just like interested in like what I think is like almost like a bit of a personality trait of writers is this sort of propensity toward the untrue. In terms of like, I don't know, this is kind of a stupid example, but I felt like anecdotally, I felt like every single time I read a really patently made up tweet, like it was some kind of like anecdote where it was like the writer would come across like, oh, like somebody said something super homophobic at the Starbucks and I did an epic clap back and everybody laughed at the mean person and said I was clever. And like whenever you would see something like that, you would always go to that profile and that person would always be a writer. and I was just, and would have like, would be like plugging some kind of, would be plugging like a novel that was like traditionally published, and I always thought that was so interesting. and then that kind of firmed it up for me that I was dealing with somebody who wasn't necessarily telling the truth or didn't necessarily care if they were telling the truth as long as they were telling an interesting version of a story, and kind of felt like they had de facto control over this narrative.
Yeah, I really feel that with those tweets when people write, you'll never believe what my like 4-year-old said the other day, and it's something so unlikely.
Yeah, it's often, you like I said, you go to that person's profile and it's like, I've got my like young adult fantasy novel coming out with Simon and Schuster in like 6 months, and I don't know, one has to wonder if those sort of made up tweets are like a marketing tactic or something. I don't know, but they're very, oh, I don't know. I feel like it happens less now, but it's, I also use Twitter a lot less, so I'm not not as aware of the hot made up tweets of the minute.
So one thing I absolutely adored about this book and found actually really quite uncomfortable to read were the really complex, nuanced political relationships between girls in their late teens. What was that like to write? Because there must have been, I mean, I found it actually quite triggering in many points.
Yeah, it was a lot of sort of just sitting down at my desk and having like unpleasant like flashbacks to high school. And yeah, I was just kind of like thinking a lot about the sort of dynamics I either witnessed or was party to at school. And I don't know, in some ways I'm kind of lucky in that I was always like very introspective and used to always think about the way people spoke to each other and kind of the way power dynamics and relationships worked. But also I just sort of remembered a lot of stuff like that. And it was kind of like bringing little bits and bobs of stuff that I remembered from school into kind of like a bit more of a fleshed out and different context. And yeah, it was interesting. And I feel like that, it seems like that's the part that's like hitting the best for a lot of people, which is good. But it did feel like kind of a drag having to sort of think about that stuff a lot, which is, I mean, I tend to get the question occasionally of like, how much do I struggle with like writing and researching dark topics? And it's sort of like, that stuff doesn't really bother me, but like reflecting on, I don't know, that kind of, those kind of like tiny day-to-day humiliations that you either caused, had caused to you, or just witnessed is like really unpleasant.
Absolutely. So you've just touched upon research there. So I'd love to dip into this a bit. Mm-hmm. I'm going to assume there was a lot of true crime podcasts listened to, true crime books read, or untrue, if you like, and Tumblr archives. Would I be right?
Yes, on the first two, but no on the Tumblr. Unfortunately, I just remember Tumblr very well and did not need to research it really that much. In terms of like true crime podcasts, it was sort of like they were more just something that I used to just listen to like casually. And then as I was kind of like, it was sort of like I was listening to them casually. And then I feel like I fell off of listening to a lot of podcasts during the pandemic. And then I sort of started writing Penance. And sort of, it was kind of like early 2021. I was doing loads of reading and research for Penance in terms of like it was partially when I was trying to settle on the voice and the kind of tidy up the structure. I just sort of felt like I need to sit down and read like a bunch of true crime stuff so I can get like a better handle on how these books are, how they sound and what they look like and how they kind of tell their stories. So I sat down and read a bunch of Brian Masters books. I read I think one of the best things I read was or probably the best thing I read was The People Who Eat Darkness by Richard Lloyd Parry, which is a fantastic book. The Killing for Company, the Brian Masters book about Dennis Nilsen, ended up being really influential, kind of quite generally, actually. There's a bunch of really interesting stuff that book does. But in terms of like the sort of depth of history and the kind of socioeconomic analysis is really interesting. It's also the same for a book called The Sleep of Reason, which is about the Jamie Bulger murder, which is also a fantastic book, which was written by a journalist who is sort of on the ground at the trial, and it's really, really empathetic and really like careful. So it's sort of, I was reading a lot of like fantastic true crime books that were really well researched and went out of their way to sort of talk about the structural things involved in the to talk about the structural things involved in kind of like creating the conditions that cause these crimes to happen. Yeah. If that makes sense. And it was then sort of being, as I was kind of like working on it and thinking like I could do with like maybe just like a top up of listening to something about this case and then going back to like true crime podcasts and finding them just like so under-researched and banal and disrespectful and just crammed with like these obnoxious advertisements for home security systems, particularly insidiously, but mattresses and meal delivery kits. And I think after reading like some of the best of the true crime genre, which really kind of the kind of books that really, really justify its existence, and then going back to like the kind of content that needs to be quickly churned out week to week, where you kind of like the people hosting the podcast are either, you know, they might as well be reading a Wikipedia page, or they've read a book and they're basically just condensing down the information in the book rather than doing any of their own research. It's yeah, they were very difficult to go back to. And I think that's about when I sort of started adding in the podcast transcript stuff that's in Penance, because because I was just finding it so, like, I don't know, just really obnoxious and really difficult to listen to, kind of regardless of what angle they were coming at it from. Yeah.
Yeah, I've personally find true, like, the thought of, you know, when people go to sleep listening to true crime podcasts, I'm like, wow, you must be so much more mentally stoic than I am, because I couldn't think of anything more harrowing, really.
Yeah, I think for a lot of people it comes from like this is something that I completely empathize with as well, and I feel like it's something that I have done, not so much, I can't fall asleep while I'm listening to stuff because I just stay awake, but with reading stuff, is that I feel like if you're a very anxious person and your brain is constantly kind of like creating the worst case scenario, it can actually be oddly like soothing to read about the worst case scenario. So I think for some people it's kind of almost coming from that place, where it's like it's like your kind of lizard brain seeking as much morbid information as possible, so it can be as prepared as possible for like the worst possible things to happen, which is not necessarily healthy, but I can see why people end up doing that and almost find it quite like relaxing.
Yeah, that's so interesting. So this book Penance is set against the backdrop of the Brexit vote. When did that decision come into your writing of the book?
That was quite early on. I knew that I wanted the crime to have been overshadowed by a major news story. It was initially, I was kind of thinking about there's a couple of sort of real life cases that I was drawing from for this book, and one of them was the murder of Suzanne Kappa, which was just like a really horrible violent murder of a young woman in the UK that happened, it basically got absolutely no news coverage because it happened around the same time as the Jamie Bulger trial. And I was very interested in that, the idea that one sort of extreme crime could overshadow another. But just sort of as we are in the UK at the minute, I think we're very like, there aren't serial killers anymore because we've kind of come to, you know, technology has just developed too far for that to kind of be able to go on undetected in the same way that it used to. I know that they do still appear, and that they tend to particularly appear targeting like very vulnerable communities, but yes, so it kind of couldn't be another major crime, essentially. Also another kind of like major crime with like very young people couldn't have overshadowed this, just because we are in like very much a post James Bulger murder society, where I think like the sort of court systems are very aware of how much it costs now to anonymize people after their names have been released, which is something that does happen kind of in Penance, but yeah, so it just felt like it couldn't be another major crime. And then I was thinking about major news stories that have happened in the last 10 years that have been this sort of, like, have taken this much oxygen of the news cycle and seen it just completely dominate it. And it was basically, I was stuck between the 2012 Olympics and Brexit. And Brexit won out just because I remember it better. I was, like, 22 when Brexit happened. And I was... 18, during the Olympics. So I just remember Brexit better.
Yeah, and it also leads really well into some of the characters and their families in the story, but I won't give away any spoilers. So, Eliza, we've had a couple of questions come in from listeners of the show. Mm-hmm. And Glenn has asked what advice you would have for someone querying a novel that has a dark story featuring an unlikable character. And it keeps getting knocked back by agents with the message, there's no market for dark stories. What would you say to that?
I'd probably say to have your comp titles as clear as possible. I mean, I ended up going the indie press route when I was published because I did not hear back from agents at all for months and months when I was sort of like shopping boy parts around at the start. So I mean, first, it's probably always worth remembering that indie presses are there, and also the Society of Authors are there to look at contracts for you. If you are going to, if you're approaching publishers unagented, which I would absolutely recommend that you do, as in go to the Society of Authors, not necessarily approach people unagented. If you're struggling to get agents to respond with query letters, I think, yeah, like I said, I think it is just, it's getting comp titles. It's knowing sort of the darker stuff that's come out in the last 4 or 5 years that has done well, that can kind of almost immediately like debunk that argument. It's like looking at Tessa Moshfegh's work. You've kind of got recently stuff like Sheena Patel's I'm a Fan, which has been really successful. And yeah, I guess just knowing your contemporary comp titles, I think, is probably the best thing you can do in that case. But otherwise, it's, I mean, if I think sometimes the problem with the publishing industry is that everybody can collectively make a decision about what is and isn't selling. So you might end up with like 400 retellings of Greek myths, but a bunch of agents sort of sitting around saying like, oh no, dark stories don't sell, when you can kind of look at, I mean, my career for one is proof that that's just not true.
Yeah, that's great advice. Definitely huge advocate for independent publishing here. So one more question. We've probably only got time for one more. So Kate says this book took on quite an experimental form, which she loved. Did you have to fight to get this book published in quite a risk-averse market?
I actually didn't. I think it's, I'm with Faber and Faber now. So this was acquired, Penance was acquired as like a partial manuscript, so they'd already seen like the first third of it. Yeah, I didn't have any difficulties with that, but I think the environment at Faber and Faber is very much one that like supports and nurtures the writer and kind of what they want to do and their vision. I don't know if this necessarily would have been the case if I were at a major publisher. Like, well, I mean, Faber is a major publisher, but if I was at one of the big five where there is more of a commercial sense. But I think I also just, I don't think I would see myself at a publisher or with an agent that would tell me that I couldn't do something.
Absolutely. So thank you so much for joining us. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you again. What are you working on next? Is there anything you can tell us?
I've got a short story collection coming out in November of 2024. And that is mostly done. So that is some speculative fiction, some horror stuff, a little bit of period fiction, but period as in the period is the 1970s, not like the 1870s. And yeah, so that's exciting. And then I'm doing a bunch of bits and bobs for film and TV. But sort of part of the fun of that is that often a lot of that stuff doesn't come to fruition, but you still get paid for it. So it's all of the fun of writing and none of the stress of having a thing out. So we'll see. And then, yes, obviously the Boy Parts Play is this year as well. So if you are able to get to Soho Theatre in London between mid-October all the way to the end of November, then do check out tickets. I think there are still some available.
You can buy Penance from all good bookshops. It's out now with Faber. Our next show is dedicated to the UK's biggest and brightest LGBTQ plus festival of literature, The Coast is Queer, which runs in Brighton at Sussex University at the Acca Centre from the 12th to the 15th of October. So our next book club book is Yelena Moskowitz Blaskovich's Nadiza in the Dark. Yelena will be appearing on a panel on Sunday the 15th of October titled Queer Ukraine, which is going to be absolutely excellent. You can see the full lineup and grab tickets at coastisqueer.com. We will be back next month talking all things LGBTQ+ books and writing. See you then.